Good morning, everybody. Maybe this week or this weekend, something's happened or will happen, which might be worth to talk about it a little bit. So, did you follow German politics? So, what happened the last days and what will happen this week in relation to computer security? What's new? What's happening? Maybe we discuss it because it has some impact or some relation to what we do in this lecture. Any clue? So one thing which I got about was that the German Socialist Party, SPD, discovered that trying to block child pornography on the internet isn't a splendid good idea. First, this they discovered. I think they were quite early, because we told this to them more than 9 months ago. But at that time, they had the feeling, because the population doesn't understand the technology, they could make use of that to win an election. In the meantime, the election is done, so they get a new approach to the things. And okay, so I would argue it's better to learn late than never to learn, but it should be the duty of politicians to better know than the population what the technology is, and just to tell the truth to the population. So okay, this is one issue. And just as a side remark, I assume you followed how the new government, CDU and FDP, agreed to work with the law requiring blocking of child pornography. Did you follow what they agreed? What to do? It's, from my point of view, a really, okay.
Do you mean deletion of sites before blocking?
Okay, this I would say is a good thing, that they discovered that deletion or taking down sites distributing illegal content, child pornography in particular, is much better than trying to block it. Yes, this I would say is a good thing. What is, for me, an absolute curiosity, they agreed to that as well. So they said, we'll give it a try for 1 year, first to take down the sites and the content. And only if this doesn't work satisfactorily, we are going to block it. So we are going to delay the execution of a law for 1 year. And the mechanisms to delay it, to delay the adherence to a law they did choose, was asking the Minister of the Interior, who is the boss of the Bundesamt für Sicherheit in der Informationstechnik, to tell them they shouldn't deliver any lists listing sites distributing child pornography, which is the basis for blocking that, to the internet service providers. And for me, this is absolutely shocking that politicians don't understand that if they made a law, this law has to be adhered to. It's not just that the minister says, hey, I don't like the law, so I'm going to tell some institution not to fulfill it. So you have to change the law. You have to revoke it. You have to admit that you made a mistake. Quite probably you made one. And for me, okay, the good news is, okay, they start to understand technology a little bit better. Okay, the situation is better, it's not election time, so maybe a truth is more important if it's not about elections. But the approach of some politicians just ignoring a law which at the moment isn't enforced because the president didn't sign it into effect, but Okay, the mere idea, if we have a law, we are going to ignore it for 1 year, I think it's somewhat strange.
I think a real reason for this 1 year delay is, we all know our government had a little bit tricky and complicated start, and the whole media is focusing on them. So I think next year during the football championships, maybe then it's passed because the media lost the focus on that, I think.
Okay. Maybe, of course, different politicians have different aims, which is fully okay. So some might have the intention, as you say. So let's wait for a good opportunity to get it into force. And others, of course, have the intention, hey, if we really try to take down sites distributing child pornography, we'll see that it works. By the way, did you, this is now not really recent news, just news I got in the spring this year. Why are so few sites taken down internationally? Because in German, the federal police said, hey, if you detect child pornography, we are not directly addressing the site operator if it's in a foreign country. We are addressing the federal police at that country. And then it's their duty whether they do something or not. And often, quite often, this kind of procedure took quite long. And of course, on its way, some messages got lost. It's a bureaucracy, so okay. So what initiatives trying to protect children did is, they did send an email to the site operator. Hey, you are hosting content probably you wouldn't like to host. And by the way, quite probably it's illegal what you do. So you should take it down. And the success rate of sending an email to site operator is really extremely high. Because normally nobody likes to host child pornography. So giving a little bit more encouragement to the German federal police just to address ISPs, content providers directly, and giving them notice would be a splendid good idea. Okay, so this was one issue. Other things happening. One thing is going to happen tomorrow.
Yeah, asking the site operators directly would be a splendid good idea, as you said, but as Jörg Sierke already said, they are not allowed to. The BKA can't do that as an official representative of Germany.
Oh, yes, but I think this is a plain excuse. What I don't expect them to do, write a letter, an official federal police letterhead, we request you to take that down. This surely wouldn't be legal and this shouldn't be done. But what they surely could do is send very informal an email, no official letterhead, no statement that they are an official body within Germany. They could even ignore that. They could just give notice, hey, under that URL, you are hosting illegal content. Please do whatever you deem is appropriate. And taking that kind of approach, my feeling is, would be completely legal. And it should be done. But, of course, if you want to have more empowerment, more employees, more power, okay, then you will argue, we are not allowed to do, we need a particular law. Okay, it's the usual game, we want more money, we want more power, and not primarily we want to solve a problem. Okay, this is my very subjective feeling, but I really have reason to believe what I just said. Okay, so what's going on this week? what's going to happen? Okay, on Tuesday, tomorrow, we'll have an oral trial before the German Constitutional Court about data retention. You did read in the newspapers that roughly 35,000 people appealed to the German Constitutional Court because they saw their fundamental right of information privacy violated by data retention. You all know what data retention is? Or should I explain it? It's explain? Okay. Communication providers, and this goes from telephony providers to internet service providers, are required to store for 6 months who communicated to whom, when, how much. So not the content, but all the data about connections, which is stored with the telcos. And if authorities, federal police, secret service, approaches that telco, probably presenting an order of a judge, but this might depend on the interpretation of the law and how it gets into force, then telcos are required to hand over data who communicated to whom to that authorities. And in some sense, this might be very appropriate. Let's assume a child is kidnapped. You get a telephone call, and now you ask the telco to trace back who did the telephone call. So just revealing one connection. There, I would say this is appropriate because the child is kidnapped. We want to get it free again, and it has to be fast, etc., etc., etc. And of course, it could be some kind of very broad request. Let's assume you have a website which gives you detailed information about, let's say, some infrastructure some people deem they are security and safety relevant, then it could be that they might say terrorists usually are looking for appropriate targets, so we want to have all the IP addresses of those guys asking for that content over the last half year. And then I would say, doesn't seem very proportionate. And of course, if data is stored, and it has to be stored in a way that it is accessible at quite short notice, I think the formulation is, if you get a request for the data as a telco, you have to answer that request without undue delay, which probably means if you are a larger telco, you have to answer the query within a few minutes, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. If you are a very small telco, or if we are running our anonymity service, then without undue delay probably means within half a working day or something like that. Because surely nobody can require us to have a 7 days a week, 24-hour service. So my argument would be, if the data shall be available without undue delay to the authorities, then probably foreign secret services and organized crime sooner or later will get access as well. And of course, you could be, oh, it's easy to see, it's easy to assume that organized crime and foreign secret services are very much interested who communicated to whom. So this will be the issue tomorrow. There will be an oral trial. The judges will ask different actors several kinds of questions. And I'm one of the expert witnesses at that trial, so they might ask me about technology. And my feeling is, and this is what I want to talk about and ask you, what is the main message to convey to the judges? And my feeling is, the main message is, if you are storing data and you store it in a way that it can be accessed in reasonable time, then it's really hard, and I would argue practically it's impossible to keep it secure. So unauthorized guys will get at the data. So it's an absolutely open question whether storing that data will make the Earth a safer place or a more unsafe place. So probably this will be my main statement tomorrow. Do you feel I should argue differently? What would you state? How would you argue? Because first I'm asking, really, I have to decide what I say tomorrow, so I want to discuss it a little bit. And secondly, you remember one of my aims was, why I give this lecture, you should get a security expert with your own opinion, with your own judgment. So I think it's a good exercise for you, thinking about, hey, if they would ask that question to me, what would I answer? How would I argue? So any feelings about that? Any statements?
For all these reasons, I have another question. How can the provider ensure that the data integrity is secure? You know, maybe someone who does not like you and has your contact data, change the data that you might have connections to Al-Qaeda, I don't know, and on the next day the police is in your room and you're in jail, but you don't never have a connection to them.
Okay, first I would assume that at least in Germany, telcos and internet service providers of course try to adhere to the law. This is a general assumption. It's clear policemen know that not all data you find in a computer is correct. So it might be that some data are manipulated and for the purpose of laying wrong traces or accusing the wrong guy. So probably a judge would look for other evidence as well, not just what is in computer files. Of course, it's not only about the, as you said, confidentiality of that data, but about its integrity as well. Just to give you a feeling, if we want to protect integrity, what we would need is that the computer storing the data digitally signs it. Of course, if this computer is hacked, you can also digitally sign manipulated data. And secondly, of course, we would assume that all the data which is stored, which is retained, is encrypted before storage. So encrypted, for example, using asymmetric cryptography. So hopefully this is done. At least we do it with respect to our anonymity service we run. But then it gets tricky. Even if you assume that the cryptography is secure enough, if you have to provide 24 hours a day, 7 days a week service, then several people have to have access to the keys for decryption, and so on and so forth. And usually, if you get a request for that data, at the moment, they are going to send you a fax. And you know how easy it is to fake a fax. What we usually do is we call them back. We call, first we check whether this is really a court we get the fax from. We call it back before handing out any data. But I would assume if you're part of a business, you want to keep cost down. So probably will not invest much time checking whether the fax is genuine. You will just try to answer and get rid of the transaction. So this is one of the reasons I would argue building that in a secure fashion is really hard and in practice might be impossible. Okay, so this is one issue. You will hear in the press tomorrow evening or on Wednesday what has been said, and we'll see what's going to happen. For me, the main statement or the main issue is that usually IT professionals give the impression to politicians that they can implement any policy. That is, a policy that we are going to retain the data and we are only retaining it for the good guys. This is a nice policy, isn't it? And they pretend that they can implement it. And probably, and this is really an issue, nearly nobody stands up and says, sorry, but we can't reliably implement that kind of policy. So you have to think about what's happening if we fail to implement it in the correct fashion. And I would assume that tomorrow this issue will be, let's say, heard by the Constitutional Court, and usually they think about those arguments. And I'm fairly disappointed that politicians usually don't do. It's the primary, let's say, task of politicians to do that kind of deliberation. And in Germany, I have mainly the feeling it's this Constitutional Court who does it, but it should have been done many steps before that. Do you want to?
Yeah, I would also argue that the judges should be presented with many examples how to hack the system. For instance, as you said, to fake data, for instance, MAC addresses, IP addresses, or to ask for access to the data by people that are not allowed to, and maybe
yes,
they can send a fake.
Probably this will not be shocking news to those judges, because just take the perspective of a judge. A judge is leading a trial. And what is absolutely trivial, that many persons will not tell the truth. They will lie. So not getting told the truth is no news for judges. It's the usual procedure they are trained for. So having, let's say, some data from computers, after they learn that those data may be manipulated, this is not really a problem. All data in a trial can be manipulated. You never know. So judges are trained to find out by cross-checking, etc. So I would assume what you mentioned should be mentioned, just to give them the information that judges shouldn't rely on computerized data just because it's computerized data. This would be quite stupid. But that they can't rely completely on that, it's a non-issue. It's absolutely clear. So I think it should be mentioned, but it will not be one of the main points. Okay. So this is what you might have read in the press and thought about.
the people try to, I don't know what their main goal is, if they try to find terrorists with these mechanisms, I would argue that they would use communication techniques where it's not easy to detect the communication at all by these protocols.
Sure. Or whenever you are storing evidence, those who have something to hide will try to escape it. And this surely is an argument that terrorists and organized crime, usually they have lots of money. So they can acquire radio technique from the military, spread spectrum, it's the best word, where you can send without people not having the key used for spreading your message in different frequency bands. So someone not having the key will not be able to detect that anything has been sent. So it has to be assumed that terrorists and organized crime mainly can escape data retention. So mainly it's the good guys and the stupid guys whose data are really retained. Okay, yes?
You mentioned that the data is maybe false, is not shocking news for the judges, which is absolutely true, I agree. But what is with the impact on the privacy of a person that is falsely identified as some sympathist or a terrorist itself, as we have seen with at the example with the Militante Gruppe, with the what was it? I think a lecturer from Berlin that was jailed for many weeks innocently, and I think this is an impact we can just not accept.
Yes, this surely is a larger problem. But again, it's not very specific to data retention, because whenever you're doing some kind of investigation, sometimes you're doing an investigation against people which later on either are proven innocent, or at least you cannot gain enough evidence to put them into jail. So this again is something pretty old. And usually, if we hand out information, data, to authorities, usually they cross-check it and they don't publish that, hopefully. So again, I would say, not really new. Of course, if authorities would publish that data quite early, or if some journalists could hack the data retained and publish, oh, those people did this and that, then it would be an issue. But usually the police is asked to keep discretion. They don't succeed in doing so all the time, and sometimes there are compromises. If you want to get the help of the population at large, of course you are going to publish something, otherwise the population at large can't help you. But again, it's not very specific to data retention. Okay, so I hope if you're reading the newspaper over the next days that you start forming your own opinion about the issue, that you think how you would have argued, and you take note who in that kind of debate did understand what kind of argument. Because usually, if you are an expert witness, it's not only the question, do you have an argument, but can you make your argument to be understood? Okay, some people don't like it and don't want to understand it, okay, then you shouldn't invest too much effort that those people understand it. But many people would be willing to understand your argument if it's explained clearly enough so they can understand it. So, okay, I think this is a good exercise. It's not a formal exercise, so I don't give it a number. So, form your own opinion and think how you would act in that arena. And I think sooner or later, some of you will be in a position to do that. Maybe it's 10, 15 years from now, but sooner or later, some of you will be in a position being expert witness in a trial. And you should be prepared for that. Okay, any other discussion you want to do about what's going on in the real world? Okay, then let's do the exercise. So what do we have to do? We have the exercise about the Wernham cipher.
First, okay. I have another question in regard to the exercise 3.8.
Okay.
If I could use the blackboard.
Sure.
So it's 3.8.
Yes. So here we have a chart. Maybe we give you a mic, then it's easier for others to understand you, and maybe it's even easier for the recording. Please, it's okay.
Last Friday we discussed with Benjamin the exercise 3.8. It was the
sorry, maybe it's not. Oh, then you should speak louder.
It was the. The exercise 3.8b, and we came up with a solution like this, and we have an asymmetric encryption with a C, then the symmetric key K1, and another symmetric key for the MAC, that is for the data we want to send.
Okay. So your statements are, we are generating a new key K1 and a new key K2.
Yes.
This key is used for confidentiality, for secrecy.
Yes.
This key is going to be used for integrity, for authentication.
Right.
And we want to protect the data.
Yes.
So we are going to use this key to encrypt the data and some other stuff. We have that key, okay, protected with respect to confidentiality. We have that key. This probably is a signature of the sender, right? So we have this key signed for authentication. And then we are using the key K2 for calculating a MAC for the data, right? This is
right.
What you do, okay? And now your question.
Now the question is, is that solution stronger than that solution if we use the signature for K1? Or are the both examples the same?
Sorry. First, before we're comparing it to anything, what is the weakness of your first solution? The weakness is that you are authenticating a key. And if you're just authenticating the key, what does this signature tell us? Let's assume I just take some color. Let's assume we have a party A sending that to a party B, right? Then we have our usual actors, Alice and Bob. Then we would say, this is the signature of Alice, right? Okay. If Alice signed this, maybe the semantics is, the signature means, I did generate this key, right?
Yes.
But in this message format, we have nothing which tells us Alice generated this key for use with Bob. And this may be a security weakness. So if you look at my slides, I probably did put into the signature the identity of B. And maybe you even should put into that a kind of timestamp. So you know that this kind of signature is recent. If this is done, then I would say, okay, after looking at it, let's say 2 minutes, I have the feeling it might be okay. Of course, I don't say that analysis should stop after 2 minutes. So before putting that to practice and implementing it at a large scale, maybe we should think a little further on it. But okay, that's the first step. And now you want to compare it to a second version, right?
Yeah, the second version we could add the B here. And now the question is that second example any stronger than the first example?
So the main change is in your second example that you added this, right? Yes. So what you did put into is some kind of I generated the key one, right?
Right.
And so if I would just add whatever I would add in my notation, then I would add a B here. I would add, this is the signature key of A, and of course I would add a B here, and again this is the signature key of A, right? And now let's compare it. The question is, if later on B is to answer towards A, do we assume that for that direction, key one is reused? If key one is reused, I really would argue that we need it. So if you want to do this, we need it.
To make sure the key K1 is only assumed for the member B.
Yes, so that B knows that by this signature, A generated the key. The key is recent, that is, it's not compromised a long time ago. Mm. And it's for use with B. And then you may reuse it. As long as you don't reuse the key K1, I don't see a difference between the two versions with respect to security. But again, this is my opinion after looking at it a very few minutes. So hopefully what you see is, if you want to reuse it, you need that. This probably is clearly to argue. And if it's only used once, I would argue this has nothing to do with authentication. A knows that A generated that key, so adding that doesn't give any additional, let's say, certainty for A what he did. And for B, confidentiality is only, in any case, as good as it was on A's side. Because if A's computer is compromised, or A does, using weak keys, the game is over anyway, irrespective of what is done here. So I would argue the only issue is if B is expected to reuse the key. Without that, I would argue it's really the same. So I have the feeling that even after thinking for quite some while, it will stay as I explained. Of course, to gain certainty, you would have to write down the arguments I just gave, step by step, and see whether this is convincing for you.
Okay.
Okay? So it was a good question. And thank you for raising it. I hope you understood what we talked about and it's clear, or does anybody else have questions? Because I think those questions are an opportunity just to get deeper into some problems and some solutions, hopefully.
Because of the signature of A, the key 2, I know that A is A, and so why I don't can reuse key 1 for encryption.
Okay. The argument, I just try first to better understand your argument and to make it more explicit. You are arguing this part tells me K2 is fresh,
yes,
is genuine, and since this genuine part is encrypted is something where we don't know much about the key properties, whether it's fresh, it's genuine, we don't know. This part gives some kind of assurance about this key, right? This is your argument.
Yes.
Assume I'm going to hack A's computer,
yes,
for some while. Being able to generate that kind of token, maybe this goes unnoticed, A never does detect that. Then I have that kind of token. And of course, later on, much later, I can generate keys K1, use that token, and then, given your argument, or the trusting that kind of argument you do, B would be willing to reuse K1. So then B would communicate using a key where he does not know that this is recent. Because if you hack that machine, maybe you are generating thousands or millions of those tokens with all timestamps you will have in the future. So in some sense, I understand your argument. And your argument is pretty close to what we do in real life. Hey, if you get an envelope and what you find in is a letter, which is convincing for you, probably you don't check the envelope much. You just read the letter and have the feeling, oh, this is authentic. And therefore, quite probably, the envelope will be okay. Don't care. But if you are reusing something, I really would argue you should care. Do you see?
Yes.
Okay. Further questions? Oh, it gets really interesting. That's good. Okay, so let's do a timestamp. We have more colors. I think we could use orange. So I would like to have first a timestamp here. So I would like to have a T here. If we do, and of course the same would be true here. And if we are going to use or to authenticate K1, I would like to have a T here as well. So the point is, whenever we want to authenticate something, timing is an issue. I first thought whether maybe I use still another color. I of course thought whether we should have a time here as well. But I think it's nonsense. It doesn't help. Because this is only for confidentiality. So it doesn't tell me anything. Maybe we'll get to the exercise of the one-time pad that you see. If K is a key, for example, the one-time pad, then you could quite easily change the time here. So we'll come across an exercise where you see if someone is using the one-time pad, or later on we will see if someone is using the pseudo one-time pad, generating a pseudo random stream. And if you want to change the plain text, it's in some situations pretty easy. You just change the ciphertext in an appropriate way. So if you know what is the current time, you want to change it, it's easy to do. So I would say putting it here is nonsense. And by the way, if sooner or later you are designing protocols, my argument is keep it simple. Don't attach timestamps everywhere just because you have the feeling, hey, it's not really very expensive and usually it doesn't weaken your protocol, just put it in. Yes, maybe it doesn't weaken your protocol. Maybe it's not too expensive, but it makes the notation more complicated and it will hinder human beings understanding the protocol. Therefore, I wouldn't do it. So whenever you put something in, you should have an argument why you put it in and what you want to achieve with it. And hopefully another argument why it really achieves what you want. Okay, you want?
Another weakness in the first example, if I let out the B, like my first version, could it be that there's another entity like C, and A sends to C that message only with the symmetric key with a signature from A, and tells C, okay, I will give you $100. And now C sends this message to B, and then B could also say, I got a message from you. This is signed with your signature. You will give me $100. Is that possible?
Okay. I'm not sure whether I fully understood your question, so I first try to repeat it, right? And you help me and correct me if I get something wrong. So you say, we are going to introduce a third actor called C, right? And C first gets from A some kind of message, right? So A is sending some message to C, and same message format. And probably now the interesting part is here we have a signature of A. We have a key. Shall the key later on be reused? Shall this be key 2?
It's easy.
Or another key?
No, it's K2.
So, okay, K2. It's used with C, and it has a time-stamped T star, right? So this is what we do.
Not the signature. I only sign the key as the first version. First version. Yes.
Okay, now I make a long story short. If you omit this, then your attack would work. And that your attack then would work, from my point of view, is an argument that you really have to include the addressee in your signature. Okay? Further questions? I enjoy your questions, so please continue. It's nice. And hopefully it's nice for you as well.
Can we make this generous that we always can say if we authenticate to somebody that we must address him? Is this always to do?
Now it's very, very broad, your statement. I think the idea probably is okay if I'm going to sign statements, I'm going to give you $100, then probably I should be interested who you is. If it means I give one person $100, okay, I know it's cost me $100. If the audience is fully open, so it might be a statement, whoever presents me the bit string is getting to get $100. Then maybe I'm a poor man. So in some sense, if I'm promising something, I have to make sure to whom the promise is valid. So this is first statement, and this obviously is true. The second thing is, if you're talking about symmetric cryptography, our basic assumption is that symmetric keys are generated and are known to two participants. So if you need some kind of authentication of keys, I would say it's obvious that the kind of authentication of the key should include who the two participants are. If you don't do that, then we take the risks that some things are replayed, some signatures are reused, some confusion arises. So we take the risk that the key is known and used by more than two entities. Maybe for some applications this is okay, but if it isn't okay, we need that kind of signature. So this is a statement I would subscribe to. And for me, again, this is a policy in the back of my head. I have the feeling this is something you have to discover. If I just tell it to you ex cathedra, hey, it's a relation of two entities, so you have to do it. You will forget it within minutes. But now, hopefully, you have seen if you are generating something, we want to know that it's fresh, it's genuine. The purpose should be stated. Okay, so the purpose should be part of the certificate. Okay, and so hopefully the knowledge you gain is much deeper than if I just tell it ex cathedra. Okay, further questions? If not, then we go to the Vernon cipher. Part A is, please calculate a small example. Anybody a volunteer to do it? Okay, I'm not insisting in that we do it, but just be warned. In doing an example, you will come across the following problems. Are you writing bits from left to right or from right to left? You will come across the problem that the group operation has to be defined. Things like that. So in some sense, an example sounds extremely easy. But I would really argue do it, because then you are fixing some notation in the easy part of an exercise. And if the exercise gets more complicated, then the notation already should be clear. But it's your decision. I don't insist that we do part A. We can go to B or C immediately. I don't mind. Okay, so nobody wants to write A. Okay, fine. So let's do B. The security of the Vernon cipher with adding modulo 2 was proven in the lecture. You remember? It was that kind of proof. Let's see. You remember? I argued we can see a 1, and behind the 1 can be 1, 1, or, behind the 0. I should really read it and point at it. Green case, 0. Attacker sees 0. Behind that can be a key value 0 and a plaintext value 0, or a key 1 and a plaintext 1. So both possibilities are possible. And since keys are equally likely, the probabilities of the plaintext are not changed. Same argument for the 1. So this was the easy argument for the case that we are sending single bits, and single bits are encrypted bit by bit, right? So this was a proof for the Vernon cipher mod 2. Now the question is, how would you generalize that kind of proof? So prove this for addition in arbitrary groups. How would you do that? So two possibilities. Either someone stands up and writes it on the blackboard, then we can read the proof and discuss about it. Or maybe someone just wants to discuss about the proof, then we can do it orally. But probably we'll lose much of the audience then. And of course, if you still say it's too trivial, okay, then we can skip it. And then we do it in an oral examination. That's fine with me. So how would you? Yes. So a group has, for example, a number of elements. You have a group operation. And I would like to see a proof that for each group you can define a Vernon cipher. I think we had that kind of definition. Let's just see. We had this definition where we said we take a coding of our plaintext message as a sequence of group elements. Then we apply the group operation for encryption. by interpreting the key as a sequence of group elements as well. Then we do decryption. And finally, we reinterpret the plain text, for example, as a sequence of bits again. So to give you a feeling, maybe we do addition mod 2 to the power of 8, then we do it bytewise. Or you could say you could add up mod 26 for the usual alphabet size, whatever you do. And you know, of course, we have groups for any number of elements, so no problem. So this was the meaning of the exercise. So how would you address it? And hopefully, if a proof is good, it delivers some insight. It's not just that we are doing a proof for the sake of having a proof. Okay, this is valid as well. For some truth, you should have a proof. But mainly, we are doing proofs because if it's a good proof, it gives us an idea why the statement holds. So, did you try? Did anybody try?
Maybe it's would be a good we have the ciphertext, and we all know that every ciphertext in the random cipher could have endless playtext or endless keys and combination of that. Then you have to try all the keys to get to playtext and.
And depending on the length of the ciphertext you already get, it could take endless time. You have so much possibilities, therefore it could be impossible for a computer to solve the problem.
And I would say this is not the proof. And in some sense, I even would argue it has nothing to do with the proof. What you now try to address in some sense is kind of complexity theoretic security. You try to argue there are so many possibilities, I can't try them out all. But if we are talking about information theoretic security, we assume the attacker can try them all out all. But now comes the addition. Even if he tries them out all, it doesn't deliver any additional information. That is, probabilities don't change. So just to be more precise, what we had here is definitions of security. So in some sense, if you want to prove it secure, you have to refer to some kind of these definitions and then argue that the one-time pad for any group fulfills one of the two definitions. So this is what is needed. So going back to here, does anybody wants to do it?
We can find for every character in a ciphertext that we might intercept, we can choose any element of the group as a chosen plaintext character, and then can find another element of the group that by addition yields exactly that ciphertext character, and there's always exactly one element because it's a group, and so we have this constant that you just showed on the slide is one. We have one key that yields for any chosen plaintext character the ciphertext character, and by that it's information theoretically secure.
Okay, I just try to repeat. I think it was correct what you said. Your first statement is you take the first definition. Why do you take that? Because this is a definition about counting. And as I mentioned last week, counting is what computer scientists love, probabilities most of them don't like. So counting is easier than probability, so you take definition one. You say the constant we have will be one. Okay, this makes the definition, of course, much easier. And then what do we read? We see whatever this the ciphertext is we have, there exists exactly one key such that any possible plain text arises. So now if we put that back into the formula we have here, what do? You have a ciphertext. You choose an arbitrary plain text character, of course. And now you do calculate that there's exactly one key, giving the proper relation between the two. And what do you need from the group axioms? Probably that there's an inverse and exactly one inverse. That's it. So if you put it down formally, this is what you really need. And then you will come across that, hey, the group operation, okay, that's it. The group is some kind of structure where we have an inverse element. Great. And then probably you've understood what we are talking about. And this is what I would encourage everybody to try out. Write it down. So I think for you, I have the feeling it's clear. Within the rest of your heads, I don't look into. In some sense, this is good, because otherwise no privacy. But I can't take, let's say, the judgment and obligation whether you have to do it. It's you deciding whether it's clear for you or not. Okay, I think we both have probably the feeling that we know what we are talking about. Okay. So this might be part B. I really would encourage you to take you a white sheet of paper and try to write it down. It will be helpful for you. If you come across problems, maybe you look at the exemplary solution. If you still have problems, write an email to our email list. Okay, part C. Decrypt the ciphertext. Okay, I don't read it, you can read it. Which was encrypted with the key? Okay. And now the question is the result unique? So please, could you pass the mic? If it's green, it should work. If it's red, you have to move the mute.
Okay, it works. I think the result isn't unique because nothing is said about the operation. So nothing is said modulo which number we calculate. Mm-hmm. I calculated modulo 2, as we did it already, but it could be also modulo 4 or 8 or something like that.
Yes. That is, whenever you get the splendid good idea that you give someone a long random string and say, hey, now we know how to encrypt towards each other, you shouldn't forget fixing the group, right? Okay, what do we do once and for all? If you forget to fix a group, what should be the default value? Mod 2, because this works in any way. But please remember, this is only one possibility. There might be others, and for some applications, having other group operations is really useful. If it's just about end-to-end encryption, you could do it mod 2, no problem. But we will see protocols where doing it mod some larger number really pays off. Okay. Part D. An attacker intercepts a long ciphertext and wants to invert the third bit from the right of the corresponding plaintext. So probably the bit corresponding to that ciphertext, the plaintext bit, shall be changed. What must the attacker do if the ciphertext is computed modulo 2? So what do you do if it's mod 2? And you want to invert the plaintext? What do you do?
You just have to invert the bit of the ciphertext.
Okay.
And you're done.
Okay. And by the way, this is just a reminder here. This is what I pointed at. If you would just put in here a timestamp, we could change the timestamp in some kind of coordinated fashion or using that kind of trick. Okay. What shall we do if it's mod 4? Is this now as easy?
I would answer this question also. The problem is, if we only want to change the third bit and it is computed with mod 4, we have to consider that the fourth bit could be also changed. So we have to consider we have to consider this. So the best idea is to invert the third and the fourth bit from right. So because if we now we have the third bit as a one and the fourth bit of right as a one, and if we if maybe the plain text is one and 0 and 1, so we have an overflow, and we therefore the fourth bit is also changed. So we that's the reason.
This is
it's really complicated too.
Let's just give it a try. So let's assume we have this as a plain text.
Yep.
And now you say we are adding 1, 1. So mod 4.
Mod
right?
4, yeah.
So yield 0. So this is fine. We have to take 1 here. So, okay, seems to work.
Yeah.
Okay. 8, modulo 8. Okay, maybe now it gets not really interesting because now you see it's a little bit puzzling how you do it. And so probably what you keep in your head is that the most simple one-time pad is the most simple situation if you want to skip or no, if you want to flip particular bits, right? If it's mod 2, it's particularly easy. And even if it's not mod 2, you might succeed. So what you please take with you is the Wernham cipher is really good with respect to confidentiality. I would argue it's perfect. But with respect to integrity, it does nearly nothing, which is a good argument that authentication and encryption really are two separate things. And please keep that in your mind. Even if you read textbooks, often this is confused. And it's really necessary to make a distinction here. Okay. Any more questions? So let's do it another, give it another try. So it was a 1 and a 0. Okay, then this is a 1.
And a 0.
And a 0, okay. Okay, counterexample. So in some sense, I think, to make a long story short, hopefully in the exemplary solution I did write it clearly enough, you can make certain that you're changing the third bit. This is what is asked for, but probably you risk changing other bits as well. Okay. Part E. Why is no adaptive attack possible on the key of a Vernon cipher? So usually you remember the kind of attacks. Maybe I should go back to the attacks. What did we do? We had here the attacks. So maybe we go even one further. A and B was you are attacking the key, and C was we are mainly attacking messages. And in some sense, attacking the key is, if it succeeds, is the more severe way of breaking it, because if you know the key, then in the future you can successfully attack everything. Of course, attacking the key is not a value in itself, it's only that the key gives you later on access to all the forthcoming messages. Okay, so going back, why doesn't this work for the one-time pad? How would you argue?
I would say, by definition, because a one-time pad uses a key just once. So a one-time pad isn't secure if you encrypt two messages with the same one-time pad, because then you're doing it wrong. And so if you would just use the key once, then there's no adaptive attack. Awesome.
Okay. So there's no adaptive attack because if you attack, then some part of the key is used. But that part of the key never is reused, and there's no relationship between that part and the rest of the key, and therefore no way to do it. Okay. So, part F. You know that there are 16 functions taking two bits as input and providing one bit as output. And the question is, which of those functions can you use for the one-time pad? It's pretty clear one function we already know. It's addition mod 2. Or maybe the electrical engineers would call it XOR. So how about the remaining 15 functions? Which of them are suitable? And now, of course, you have different kind of approaches. Some people would say, hey, it's only 15, so we get try them all. Some people would say 15, oh, that's an awful lot of possibilities. No, I don't like that. I want to think about it in a more structured way. So who did try to solve it? And how did you solve it?
What functions are possible? I thought that at first the function I want to use must to depend on both of the factors of the cross product. So if it only depends on one, that would be the identity of one of both or the inverse of one of both, then it would not work because it would be easy to break, in my opinion.
So either you would be able to break it, or it would not be functionally correct because you couldn't decrypt.
Yeah.
Okay.
The other two functions that would not work, of course, are those that always that always result in a 1 or 0. So the whole text that comes out is a 1 or an 0. So what remains are only those functions that depend on both factors of the cross product. And another factor that is important is that there must be some inverse operation that turns the result of this cross product back to the original text. So that's what are the requirements of the function we want to use.
And how many do remain then?
I did not calculate that. I just thought about it.
So the outcome is there are overall 2 of the 16 functions. One function you already know, it's the XOR. And the other function is just, you negated it, it's not XOR. These are the 2 functions. And probably in the exemplary solution, I hopefully have a write-up where I did take your argumentation to the end, so it's derived that it's those 2 functions and not more.
For the general case, it would be necessary that it's what we call bijektiv in German, I think. So we can just boil it down to this and just look at functions that are bijektiv. I don't know what the English word is.
Yes, sure. This is a necessary condition, yes. Otherwise, no way to decrypt. And again, I would argue, if you really want to test how good you are in formalizing things, take an empty sheet of paper and try to write down all the requirements you have on the functions, and then see how many remain. And really try to bring it to the bitter end. And then maybe you look at the exemplary solution. I try to do it there. Okay. So maybe we go to the younger cryptographer. A younger cryptographer, you know that the younger people normally have to drive innovation, right? If you ask the older people, everything shall stay as it already is. So if you look for innovation, then usually you have to ask younger people, right? So a younger cryptographer has a splendid good idea to decrease the effort of key exchange. And he argues that instead of a random key, I do use a part of a book which my partner and I have. And then we only have to agree on the book, on the page and row of the beginning. And then we can add or subtract respectively modulo with the number of characters in the alphabet, the text of the book from our plaintext. And given that the book is long enough, we have it. So we can replace exchanging a long key by just explaining or just exchanging which book we take, the page, and the position of the page. So this is innovation. By the way, this is not hypothetical. This is innovation you are going to hear whenever you ask a group of younger cryptographers how they would implement it. In each group of 20 people, that kind of proposal will pop up. So, and in the meantime, probably you have the feeling you are slightly older than that, I hope. So middle-aged cryptographers. So what kind of advice would you give to your younger colleague? So maybe you wanted to say, or?
I argue that the key is not very random, because if when I use a textbook, I have statistically more ease, for instance, in the text. So the key is not very random, as I said, and this is a weakness of the cipher.
So your first statement is, books are not random, and therefore you replace randomness by something which is not random, So this is risky, you should think about it. So this is surely an advice you should give. And in the particular situation of natural languages, roughly we know that one third in our natural languages really is entropy, and two thirds is redundancy. Which means that if you are adding up a natural language text and take as key another natural language text, still both texts by using some statistics can be understood, because it's still one third plus one third, it's below one, so still it has redundancy. So if you do it with two books, even without knowing the other books, you could just crypt analyze. And by doing that analysis, you would get the plaintext message and read parts of a maybe interesting book. Of course, this wouldn't be true if the message you are sending is not just a natural language message. If it has less redundancy than one third, this kind of argument would fail. So would your advice to your younger friend be, hey, make sure that you compress the message before encrypting that way? Maybe this would be an advice. But still I would argue, not all messages then are possible. It's not so easy to cryptanalyze it, because not all key values are equally likely. So still I would say it's not really good. But it cannot be broken deterministically, or with certainty, I should say. What are other problems? What are other approaches to break it? So assume you have a book that I have as well. Then usually it's a well-known book, right? Or at least it's a book usually you can buy at Amazon or you find in our library. So what would be another approach to break it? Just to search through all the books and see whether some reasonable plaintext arises. And if checking whether a plaintext is reasonable can be done by a computer, then you could just let your computer search. If you look at that in more detail, then surely we would argue it gets slightly expensive, because now we can calculate how many books do we have, how many positions do we have, etc., etc. So solving that kind of problem, brute force, is expensive, but for, let's say, a secret service, it's surely doable. Probably it's not so much fun if you want to do it on your ordinary PC. Takes too long and maybe not worth it, but determined attackers surely can do.
For instance, if I want to code the letter V, I know that I can code it, for instance, on page 6, comma, line X, and then I code the same letter but using the other page, and there is actually slight chance that somebody can use the brutal attack, deterministic on either attack, to see some correlation between this. I mean, the algorithm of coding is extremely difficult and inefficient, but in order to do it once or twice, it works, and for short messages. And I argue that it's a bit difficult to brutally break this key, because it's really random. I mean,
but now you're first, I just abstract a little bit. What you do is that you say, hey, if if I'm just taking a very, very small percentage within my book of all the characters.
And within one message, coding the same letters differently.
Yes. Then, because usually in an English textbook, all English letters will appear. So I have plenty of choice taking different positions for the same letter if the book is long enough. And as long as I make sure that none of the two positions I take are getting too close, because you know that if two characters are, let's say, close to each other, they correlate, for example, if you know this is a position, let's assume this is a position and you know it's a C. You are asking yourself what might be the next character, then what is probable in German and English? Probably you have an H, this could be one possibility. There could be an A. Could there be a B? I'm not sure. Needs to be checked. An X. So you see, some possibilities are much more likely than others. So your approach is fine if you only take a very small percentage of the book.
And if the message is short.
Yes. Yes. It doesn't make sense. And just to give you an idea how you could do it differently, if you have a textbook and you say it has one third entropy throughout the book, then you could slice it into three parts and add the parts. So in some sense, if you want to have a full entropy key, then just add some books and take the sum of the books as your key. Gets pretty close to what you did. Okay, so, but still, however you do it, if you start with public information, you have to consider an attack of exhaustive search. So all the books are known, it's clear that you can add up books, etc. So you get some kind of combinatorial explosion. How many books are you adding? At which position are you doing it? Are you shifting? Things like that. But still, keep in mind that some computers, some supercomputers, might be quite powerful.
To XOR it with the same randomness, and I would say that the attack on language-specific features is still somehow possible, because if we know the system, we can deduce the possibilities for the resulting key from the
beginning. Yes, but let's assume for the moment we are just, for simplicity of the argument, we are just restricting ourselves to English books. If you add up not just three English books, but I'm going to the extreme, 30 English books, character by character, then probably the distribution will be pretty close to full randomness now by 30 books. So you are sure it will not be exactly random. So some statistics, some subtle difference will not completely fade out, but they will mainly fade out. And if you think 30 books adding up is not enough, then you add up 1,000 books. It's not hard for a computer to add up 1,000 books if you tell the computer which 1,000 books to add up. And if you have all of them on your hard drive. So the main point now is that does an attacker have an opportunity to check which books do you have on your hard drive? And if he knows you are paranoid, then probably he will guess that you will add them up all. Now again, we have some kind of attack. So all I wanted to say is, whenever you do something different than just generating random bits, be very, very, very careful. So this is the main message. So innovation is nice, but innovation introducing new risks, maybe it's not really nice.
One of your points was that someone could get many books and try and find a plain text that could be possible, and for this cause it would be insecure, right? So you could use this argument with the one-time pad, like trying all the keys and finding the reasonable plain text. And so would the one-time pad would be insecure? I would want to know where is the difference between trying all the books and all the keys.
Okay. First, if there are all key values possible, then if you try them out all, what you will get in the end is all possible plain texts, which means you won't learn anything because you didn't know the possible plain text beforehand. If your key space somehow is restricted, that not all key streams are possible, but only a relatively small fraction of that, which usually is the case if your key stream contains redundancy, then, depending on the quantities of the redundancy, there may be a relation between redundancy in your plain text and redundancy in your key, that the solution gets unique. If you read the original works of Claude Shannon, then he does some calculations to determine exactly that. So yes, your feeling is right, and there's some theory about it, which I don't bring in this lecture. So I point you to the original work of Claude Shannon. You'll find it there. Okay, so for here, please take with you, books contain a lot of redundancy because usually it's natural language. Second, books usually are public. And compared to all possible books you could write, only a very, very, very small fraction of books is ever published. Maybe I should tell you the story of the Library of Babel. Did you hear about that? The very huge library? Never heard about that? Okay. The idea is the following. Some computer scientists, who of course always want to solve a problem once and for all, thought about the idea, let's create a real universal library. A library containing all books. They did some assumptions. They thought there will be no books having more than 10,000 pages, right? Because it will be too thick, so you are not willing to carry it around with you. Books should have at least some kind of character size, and pages shouldn't be too large, so maybe A2 is the largest size of a book you would be willing to take with you. So now it's pretty clear how many characters of the minimal size so everybody can read it, you can get at a side. And then they said, okay, and now it's pretty easy. Now we can generate all the possible books. So maybe the first book is all blank. The next book is all blank, but at the last position there's an A. The next book is all blank, but at the last position there's a B. And so you generate all the books. And then you have a library where all possible books are in, right? So probably you have a warm and happy feeling because now you own all books, right? Nice. So probably after considering that kind of approach, after a minute you have a good feeling. But next, probably after a minute more, you will start calculating how huge your library will be, how many books you get, and how much trees you have to grow and make books out of them. And then you will have the feeling, hey, it's not a splendid good idea. It's just unmanageable. I cannot get that library. And after still a few moments, you will say, hey, this library, assume you have it, which in practice you couldn't, but let's assume for the moment you have it, your library doesn't tell you anything. Because if you're taking a book, it's already clear what's in. So it doesn't tell you anything new. So in this sense, your library has zero information content. All books are there, but just because all books are there, zero information. So why do I tell you that kind of story? Okay, first, because it's a funny story. Yes, agreed. But secondly, just to give you a feeling that, okay, if you go to the library, there's an awful lot of books. Yes. You can't read them all as a human being. Yes. But compared to all books which might be written, it's an absolutely small fraction of the books you find in the library. 0.000, okay. Could continue for centuries, percent of all books which could be written. And this rareness of the books, this that it's only a very small percentage, this gives the value of the books. If all books would be there in the library, no value. And therefore, this is another way to approach that if you're just taking books of your library, you can't expect that what you find is randomness. Because the value just is in that it's not random what you find in a book. Randomness is so boring, human beings can't stand it. If you don't believe it, sit down with your friends, toss some coins, drink a lot of alcohol, and and the next morning you enjoy reading 2 pages of complete randomness, then either you are still drunk or you have some kind of mental illness, I would say. Okay, hopefully problem clear. You have some feeling about randomness, entropy, and things like that, I hope. So, next part. Some countries allow you to use encryption only, if you deposit your encryption key with the authorities, either beforehand, this was what was requested in France, or you have to hand over your key after the fact, after some message has been tapped, you are a suspect, in case you are accused. This is, for example, at present the case in Great Britain. And the question is, does this make sense? How would you argue? When I started to read, it's maybe 10 years ago, that in Great Britain they made a law to require people to hand over keys after they have been accused of something. So they have to hand over keys for decryption of messages. I just started laughing. I started laughing for at least 10 minutes. And the question is, why did I start laughing? Why is this so ridiculous? Because even in Great Britain, the Wernham cipher may be known. Okay, Claude Shannon, it was an American, but it used for his paper the, okay, American English, but British people could read it. And what would you tell authorities if they ask you for a key? You might ask them, hey, what plain text would you like to be the outcome? Then I'm going to calculate the key for you. So maybe if the outcome you like is God saves the queen, then I'm going to give you the appropriate key. If you like me to, okay. I hope that British humor then helps a little bit, that the authorities in Great Britain start smiling and say, okay, you have got it, so better we don't ask you for a key. But I'm not sure, not everyone in Great Britain has a good portion of humor, and maybe some authorities haven't. Okay, problem clear? I hope. Okay. Last part is what kind of storage media may you take for use with a one-time pad? And how long do they last? And this exercise, I gave you different speeds. So maybe there's a speed of text communication. So a good secretary may type 5 characters per second, being 40 bits per second if it's full entropy. Maybe we consider voice communication. So 64 kilobit per second is really a good voice quality. Or maybe we are talking about high resolution full video communication, maybe 140 megabit per second is really high definition TV. Now we have some storage media. Maybe some of you still remember the floppy disk. The CDR you know, DVDs maybe in the meantime you know better. And some of you may even know Blu-ray. So what kind of storage medium can be used for what kind of communication for how long? So it seems easy, so I hope you did calculate it a little bit. Divided, yes. Hopefully you did consider a factor 2, so maybe for some services you have two-way communication, then a factor 2 might come into play. And overall, what is the outcome? Probably the outcome is, if it's about communicating text, then any of the media will do. If it's about voice, then probably a floppy disk won't take it too long, but the other media will do. And if it's about video communication, then probably only DVD and Blu-ray will do it for some while and not too long. But first, media still gaining capacity. So we are talking now about the next generation of discs. And I did show it to you, this USB stick has 16 gigabyte. And just yesterday I checked, because for the trial for the Constitutional Court, what is the most recent capacity, it's now twice as much, 32 gigabytes. So maybe in 2-3 years, you will have really large capacities on those devices. So to make a long story short, if organized crime is not really in need of full video communication in very, very high resolution, for all other purposes, the one-time bad will do for them. I don't say that this is very nice, but this is just a fact of life. And of course, I'm very happy that if Siemens and other companies can do encryption of communication, this is usually nice for our economy, because you know that many secret services, after some military problems, are not as important as they have been 20 or 25 years ago, now specialize on industrial espionage. So usually secret services help some companies in their countries to tap to other companies' communication. There are really some good examples where, for example, German companies lost some contracts because, and now it comes as a surprise to you, because French companies got to know the German offer and adapted their offer accordingly. And now you might guess who might have given to French companies that kind of secret. Okay, think about it. So my feeling is that's what we have to say about the Wernham cipher. Do you have any questions? Any remarks? Then thank you for your patience. We now do the break. In 20 minutes, we'll start with information security, good authentication. So maybe we continue. As we learned today in the exercise, the Wernham cipher, which is the most secure symmetric encryption system, doesn't provide any reasonable authentication. So the question is pretty clear. Are there symmetric authentication systems which are information theoretically secure? Of course, we have to formalize what this shall mean. I come to that later. Next, if they are, how about key distribution? And of course, key distribution for symmetric authentication systems is exactly the same as for symmetric encryption systems. So, nothing new to be said here. And I start with a very simple example. And I describe to you the view of the attacker. And the example is very, very simple. We assume we have a plain text alphabet, which is H for head and T for tail. That is, we are just tossing coins and want to communicate the outcome. So we have mainly a binary plaintext alphabet, H and T. And we do attach a message authentication code of 1 bit length. And here I just stick to 0 and 1. So the zeros and ones here are the max, and H and T are the plaintext. So the message format is plaintext MAC. And of course, we have keys. And here in this little system, we have 4 keys. This is one key, 00. The other key value is 01. Third value is 10. And the fourth value is 11. In other words, we have 2 key bits. And we will see that we really need these 2 key bits. That is, you can't get an information theoretically secure authentication code with 1 key bit alone. And then this table tells us, I take now the perspective of the sender, if I want to send an H and I have a key value 00, then I go in this line, I take the H and I see I have to send H0. If I have the key value 01, I want to send an H, I send the same H0. If I have a key value 10, if I want to send an H, I would say send H1. And if I have a key value 11, if I want to send an H, I have to send H1 as well. So I can continue the discussion for T. If I want to send a T, if I have a key value 00, I send T0. If I have a key value 01, I want to send a T, I send T1. So for key 10, I want to send a T, T0. And for key value 11, I want to send a T, T1, right? So the semantics of this table hopefully is clear. Someone checking whether the head and tail he gets is authentic takes the following perspective. Let's assume H0 arrives. If the key value is either 00 or 01, this H is taken as genuine because the authenticator, the MAC, is okay. If the key value is 01 or 11, you see here the minus, then don't take it as authentic. Maybe head has been changed to T or vice versa, maybe the authenticator has been changed. At least in these 2 possibilities, don't take the H as authenticated. So same here, if H1 arrives, if one of these 2 key values is true, take it as authentic. If one of these 2 key values, that is these 2 key values, it's not authentic. Same for T. If T0 arrives, if it's the key 00 or the key 10, then it's authentic. Otherwise, not. If T1 arrives, if the key value is 01 or 11, then it's authentic. Otherwise, not. Okay, this is a scheme, and I hope everybody understood how it works. The next question, of course, is why is it secure? And before we can really answer that, we have to make clear what shall security mean. Okay, so question. Everybody understood how the scheme works, but do you have questions? Maybe you take a mic, then everybody understands your question, hopefully, at least with respect to audio.
This works. If we receive X and MAC, and we decrypt it, and we can find the key value. Do you mean this, or you mean that it was encrypted using the key value? So I didn't quite catch the
Which perspective do you take? The perspective of the recipient, of the attacker?
It doesn't matter if you are.
Okay. So then we have to discuss both possibilities. So let's assume you get H0. Assume you are the recipient. Then you know which of the four key values is true. Mm-hmm. So you can act accordingly. If it's one of the two first key values, then you accept it. If it's the third or fourth key value, then you know this can't be. It's not authentic.
So the question would be how I know when I receive H,0, how I know which key I...
Same as with the one-time pad, we have exchanged a symmetric key. Mm-hmm. And each time a new message arrives and is processed, we just go through the key. So we take all the key values only one time, and then we go to the next part of the key, of the long symmetric key we did exchange. So I assume here, as we assume in the one-time pad, that sender and recipient, with respect to the symmetric key, are in synchrony. Both know at which position they are.
So the sender encrypts it using the 0,0 key, and the receiver, which also who knows this 0,0 key. So I, being a receiver, having decoded it with the 0,0 key, which I know, see that it is H. I see that I received H,0. So
and
how then?
See that this fits to the value of the key you have, and if it, and then you take it as authentic. Uh-huh. And if it doesn't fit to the value you have, you say it's not authentic.
Okay, so yes, you use here.
Proceed to the next part of the key.
I use here both signature and the encryption in one.
The plain text is already transmitted in plain text because we are transmitting H and T. We are just.
We don't encrypt it, the plain text.
Why should we? It's only about authentication.
Ah, okay. Okay. Now I see what I mean. And I know. Okay. And I know that. If I receive H,0, and so if I receive H,0, what should I do then? I received H0, and
so you are the recipient. You receive H0.
Yes.
If this is one of your the key values, so your key value is either 0,0 or 0,1, you say this is authentic. I take it.
Uh huh.
Or if your key value is 1,0 or 1,1. And you see, hey, this is not authentic, so I'm going to ignore the message.
Okay.
But still I'm going to the next part of the key, so to make sure you're never using any part of the key twice.
Okay, I think I got that, thanks.
Okay, any more questions? Because before we can argue about the security of a mechanism, first we have to understand how the mechanism works, because otherwise it's really hard to talk about the effects.
If you receive a message and the authenticator is not right, so you take the message as not authentic, and then you go on and use the next position of the key, but if the message is not from the real person, so
then after that we have a problem between sender and recipient because they are out of sync or potentially out of sync. Of course, now it depends, was the message originally sent by the sender and just changed on its way, then still they are in sync with respect to the key. But if the message just has been invented, then they are out of sync. So probably it would be a good idea if the recipient doesn't take a message which arrives as authentic, then he should make sure to get into sync again with the sender with respect to the key, which is some procedure I don't discuss, but I just take for granted. Because if I'm discussing every aspect in the same discussion, it gets too complicated. So let's assume that sender and recipient have a procedure to resynchronize at which position of the key they are. Okay? So, now about the security of the procedure. So probably an attacker, now I take the perspective of an attacker. Before that, I took the perspective of the sender or recipient. Now the perspective of the attacker. The attacker could attack in a blind fashion or in a seeing fashion. In the blind fashion, he is just generating a message. Okay, maybe he wants to send a T. Then the attacker has to guess what is the appropriate MAC, because otherwise the T generated won't be accepted by the recipient, right? So now you see, he wants to send a T, he could have a MAC 0 or 1. Which one to choose? What can he do? He can just guess. Because out of the four key values, two are for MAC 0 and two are for MAC 1. So an attacker has no better chance to blindly authenticate HOT than just guessing. And guessing does succeed with what probability? Okay, if it's about guessing one bit, probability is 1/2. So here you see, probably we are talking about an extremely small example. So usually, if an attacker has a success rate of 1/2, we wouldn't call that security. Maybe the banks in the automatic teller machine, if the bad guy has a probability of 1/2 of getting your money, the banks would call that security. But we wouldn't, right? So what to do if you want to do it better, then just don't add 1-bit MAC, but let's say 50 bits max. And then chances are exponentially small. But for analysis, just let's analyze the small code. So we saw in this code, if you want to break it blindly, whether the attacker tries to behave intelligently or just randomly, it doesn't make a difference. And this probably is what we later on will formalize as information theoretically secure. An authentication code is information theoretically secure if it cannot be broken with better probability or with a better strategy than just guessing. So in some sense, it's merely the same definition as we had with the one-time pad. Of course, the attacker can guess. the plaintext. Depending on the plaintext distribution, this guess might be relatively probable, or if plaintexts are long and equally distributed, it may be quite improbable. But of course, he can guess. But he should not be in a position to do better than guessing. And again, this we do with the authentication system. Now, of course, this was only part A. And if it would be only part A, which we would have to satisfy, we could simplify the code. Until here, one bit would be enough. One key bit would be enough. But now if we are talking about how to break the system, if the attacker launches a seeing attack, you will see why we really need the two key bits. And I demonstrate to you the kind of attack or the difficulty of that kind of attack by means of an example. Let's assume the attacker launches a seeing attack. That is, the attacker gets a plain text with the right MAC. So he just intercepts something the sender says. And now he wants to change it. Because if it's happy, the attacker is happy with what's going on, he has just to do nothing. If you're happy with what's going on, you just let it go. And there's no way to prevent an attacker to just let it go. Because we are building a system that it shall function without an attacker. So no way to stop an attacker who just looks at the system and is happy. Right? Okay. So the attacker sees H0. And he wants to change it. And he wants to change the H, and since this is only a two message code, he wants to change the H to a T and gets the T accepted. And now the attacker has the following problem. Of course, he knows the code here, he knows the table. But of course, he doesn't know the key. And now he sees H0, and he knows we might have a key value 00, or we might have a key value 01, any of the two. And by the way, any of the two with the same probability. And now, and this is a trick of the code. This is the idea of the code. And now it's essential that whether he should authenticate T with the 0 or T with the 1, this distinction has to depend on whether the key value is 00 or 01. Because this is something the attacker doesn't know after seeing H0. And if it shall be difficult to authenticate T, then the authentication of T has to depend on which of the two key values is a true one. So one of the two gives 0 and the other gives 1 as a MAC. So the attacker sees H0, he knows the right MAC for H is 0, he knows one of the two keys is what sender and recipient have, but still he has a problem. Still he has no better way of authenticating the T than just to guess the MAC. Because if he does an analysis, he should choose each MAC with probability 1/2. If he just guesses, he chooses the MAC with probability 1/2. So he has no advantage by analyzing the system, by taking good use, the best possible use of all the information he has. He has no advantage above just guessing. And again, this is what information theoretical security means? If you now want to bring the analysis of the code to an end, what still would we have to do? We would have to say, okay, this is just one of four possibilities of what an attacker sees. So maybe he sees H1, then it's one of the two key values. And again, the two values make a distinction between 0 and 1. Then we take T0, it's this key or that key, and still these two values make up different values for H. And fourth and last possibility, let's assume the attacker sees T1, then the key values are 0,1 or 1,1, and for these two values, H has a different MAC. Okay. So this is a small code and an explanation why this code works. Do you have questions so far? Okay. Then let's do it a little bit more formally, because now I have to define what information theoretical security shall mean. The first thing I have to introduce is we need some error probability, epsilon. Why? If it's about encryption, we could argue the attacker sees the plain text and he does not gain any additional information. Sorry, the attacker sees the ciphertext and he does not get any additional information. Okay, this was a clear definition and we didn't need any kind of probability. With respect to authentication, a success of the attacker is if he generates a MAC and succeeds in getting message and MAC attached together, being accepted as genuine by the recipient. So in an authentication system, the attacker always has some probability of success. Because if you're just sending something random, he has some probability that it will be accepted. So in an authentication system, you cannot expect that your attacker has no chance. All you can expect is that the chances of your attacker are very, very low. Okay? Therefore, we have to introduce some error probability. And now, information theoretical security means that for all plain texts, for all message authentication codes that the attacker can see, that is, the attacker doesn't attack blindly, he attacks in a seeing fashion. So for all the attacker sees, for all plain texts, Y, not equal to X, that the attacker sends instead of X, and for all MAC, MAC prime, where the attacker chooses the MAC with the highest probability fitting Y, for all that X, MAC, Y, and MAC prime, we have the following probability VW. The probability, German Wahrscheinlichkeit, that Y authenticated with K, that this is the MAC prime which the attacker did choose, given that X is authenticated with MAC. So this second condition binds or reduces the key space to the key value still possible. This probability is smaller or equal than epsilon. So this is a definition. And in our small code, epsilon was chosen to be 1/2. And you might expect that if we go for 2-bit max instead of 1-bit max, epsilon might be 1/4. If you go to 3 bits, it may be 1/8. Okay, is the security definition clear, or do we have to discuss it? If so, please just ask, because definitions have to be clear, otherwise it doesn't make much sense to proceed. No questions? Okay, then next, I want to do some improvements of our example. I want to use 2 sigma key bits instead of 2 key bits. That is, our key now is not just 2 key bits, but sigma, 2 sigma key bits. So we had one pair of key bits, and now we need sigma ones. And now we have sigma times as much key. And now we can generate a large MAC as just a concatenation of MAC 1 until MAC sigma. We are just taking sigma bit long MACs. And we are calculating MAC I using Ki and Ki star. So in the simplest case, we just take the scheme we had, taking sigma times as much keys and calculating sigma max. Straightforward. This yields an error probability of 2 to the minus sigma. And if you now take sigma, let's say, as 50, 2 to the minus 50, okay, it's pretty small. And if you are absolutely paranoid, then take 100 and 2 to the minus 100. Okay, it's really good enough. The probability that if you're going through the streets of Dresden, that some brick is falling down and hits you is much larger than the probability of 1 to the minus 100. And this was just not, let's say, encouragement never to go through Dresden. So what do we have now? We can take the very, very simple scheme, and by just investing sigma times as much effort, we can bring down the error probability exponentially fast in sigma, which is nice, simple and nice. The next thing is, hey, in our small example, we had only 2 messages, H and T. How do we authenticate longer messages? And surprise, surprise, if you have no better idea, what do? We just authenticate a message bit by bit. I don't tell you that this is the most efficient way to do it, but this surely is the most straightforward way to do it. So let's assume we have L message bits. Then we calculate these sigma message max for each bit position. And then we have solved our problem. Okay, so what do we have? We have now, starting with a very, very simple scheme, by just taking sigma times the expense of the MAC calculation and key exchange, and doing it for each and every bit of the message, L times, we come up with a scheme which works and which is, in an obvious fashion, information theoretically secure. Why do I stress this? First, if you read textbooks by world-class cryptographers, or at least if you read their research requests for research money, then usually what you read is, hey, maybe we have quantum computers. This breaks the asymmetric systems which are in main use. So we need research money for the post-quantum computer cryptography area. So they pretend each and every system will be broken. So let's be prepared, ask for money, and do more research about asymmetric system. First, I fully agree with them that doing research in that arena is a good idea, but the argument is wrong. First, even today, there are some systems which aren't broken if quantum computers would exist. By the way, I don't believe they ever will, but okay, might happen, and maybe I'm wrong. Second, as you know, there's a one-time pad. No quantum computer ever will break the one-time pad. So, because it's information theoretically secure, yes, by definition, computation doesn't help. And the statement I wanted to make with this little code and this kind of generalization, which is really simple, so I think it took me 20 minutes to explain that. So I would assume if you take 2 hours, you should be able to explain it to your mother, assuming she has not too much attention to mathematics. But okay, if she's open-minded, it should work. So you can really explain the one-time pad and the basic idea of information theoretically secure authentication codes to everyone. It's simple. This is not how it's done efficiently. We can do better than that. But this is the most simple explanation. And I wanted to start with a simple explanation. And so coming back to my colleagues who are looking for research money, yes, it's good to do basic research, but we shouldn't pretend that if an attacker has tremendous amount of computational power, all the cryptography is broken. This isn't true. Some of the cryptography is broken. And I take that kind of fundamental approach that I start with the information theoretical secure systems just to give you a point of reference, because those systems can't be broken by more or better computation. Maybe they can be broken by breaking into your computer and getting at the key. But they can't be broken by having more computing power for cryptanalysis. Take the mic first, then it's easier.
Test. So in your example, you said the easiest way would be to encrypt just every bit for itself and not encrypt, authenticate.
Yes.
But if you do this, surely your message contains the bits 1 and 0. So if not, it's kind of strange message.
Sure.
So you just move around the bits and then you have an authenticated message.
Good question. Completely a wrong conclusion, but very good question. The point I mentioned, and I should emphasize it at least 5 times more, is that the keys here are only used once. So it's the same as with the one-time pad. If you want to have informational security, you shouldn't reuse your key, because the argument for security usually takes for granted that the key has no correlation to anything else. In particular, it has no correlation to any keys you used before. And therefore, your point is absolutely right. All the bits of a message are authenticated independently, but the authentication depends on the position in the message. So for each position in the message, there's a different authentication.
So you effectively have no seeing attacks because you always change the key?
No. Let's assume, okay, depends now. I shouldn't say no. I should say it depends, because this makes the answer more interesting. The scenario is, let's assume you are a good guy and he's a good guy. I'm the bad guy, okay? So you send a message to him. You send the message, and I interfere in between. I take the message, so it's not going to make it to him. And this is now the seeing attack. I have the message you sent. I can do some analysis, and I can forward to him another message instead of the message I just took out of the communication network. So this is a kind of seeing attack. I think it was very good questions, and it helped me to make the point more clear. Okay? If four other people ask the same questions, it would be very, very good, because these points have to be made clear. It's better we make it here five times than some of you go into the examination and haven't understood that these key bits are only used once. Okay. Further questions? So,